Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Two regular guys take on the job of documenting Appalachia's culture and history.
People are looking for something to believe in, and I think that that's what we're trying to give them is we do believe in Appalachia. We believe in the people. We believe in where we're from.
A new book explores the meaning behind the name Wheeling.
Indians are talking about Wheeling. These are Indians who have never been to Wheeling. For some reason, Wheeling holds a certain spell over them.
Looking at Appalachia is still looking for photographs of the region.
It's showing me families fishing.
And a West Virginia soldier is honored to be a member of the Old Guard.
I carry America's faith and honor against her enemies. I am the queen of battle. I am what my country expects me to be, the best trained soldier in the world.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The Appalachian region has been reported on, documented, and studied quite a bit in the past 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson came to the region to declare a war on poverty. But two friends, one who lives in Johnson City, Tennessee, and the other in Dickinson County, Virginia, are hoping to make a documentary showing what's good about the area. The Appalachian Project, or TAP, was started earlier this year by Shane Simmons of Johnson City and Jason Barton of Dickinson County. Barton says they are collecting stories from people who live in a specific part of Appalachia.
We're really focused in on, you know, the Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, and North Carolina areas.
The Appalachian Project is looking for articulate, older people willing to share interesting stories that highlight the region's heritage and culture. Simmons and Barton mention coal miners, nurses, loggers, and soldiers as good candidates.
Anybody that, you know, has that interesting backstory that can shed some light on how Appalachia used to be and, you know, in a positive light.
It's important to Barton and Simmons to collect stories that are positive, and they think that's something Appalachians crave.
We're not some city slickers coming in trying to, make an Appalachian documentary that's been done so many times and, you know, cause people to worry. Because when we first started this project up, we got a lot of emails instantly, you know, saying, please, can you focus on the positive things of Appalachia and not the negative things? Because we've heard and seen and so many things, that's projected negatively in the mountains. And, we, of course, would never do that. That's the opposite of our goals.
Do you think people are weary of that picture of Appalachia?
I think so. And it's kind of funny. Just this morning I think it was the New York Times had an article about Kentucky, and it was painting a very unflattering, and the three things everybody seems to want to talk about is drug addiction, poverty, and lack of education, which there are problems everywhere, and you don't want to minimize that. That's certainly an issue that has to be addressed, but, you know, what we're just trying to do and is to paint the positive picture. A lot of people ask us what that means, and it's just telling the full story.
Barton and Simmons are not documentary filmmakers, not even close. One is a banker and the other sells insurance. They were called to document Appalachia during a road trip last year to New Orleans. They took a break in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and met a really interesting older man who seemed like he had a good story to tell. Simmons says another goal is preserving the culture.
Social media and the world is, and America is becoming more homogenous just because, you know, we all watch the same shows and we all connect that way, and you can make friends and, you know, other countries online and that type of thing. But we want to keep the reason we're focusing on the older generation is to keep that, some of those traditions alive and preserve that.
Simmons and Barton are finding people to interview through social networking. They've created a Facebook page, a sort of virtual meeting place where folks from the region can share stories, historical facts, photos, thoughts, and ideas. It's also a great way to find potential interviewees for the documentary. And based on the response, Appalachians are anxious to have their story told.
You know, we get the emails that say, you know, this, your Facebook page alone, you know, has made me so much more aware of my heritage, has made me so much more proud of where I come from. And that's things that, you know, we are making a difference in the world already with what we're doing.
People are looking for something to believe in, and I think that that's what we're trying to give them is we do believe in Appalachia. We believe in the people. We believe in where we're from, and we're hoping that that translates, and I think that's what people are seeing, and that's why we're getting so much support from so many different areas.
Simmons and Barton hope to continue collecting videotape stories until the end of the year. They then plan to use these stories in the documentary. That New York Times article mentioned by Shane Simmons also got the attention of another Appalachian who happens to be the editor of the rural news site, The Daily Yonder. The New York Times analysis found that eastern Kentucky's Clay County ranked dead last in a study of the nation's toughest places to live. Another five counties in Kentucky's eastern coalfields also ranked in the bottom 10. Times reporter Annie Lowry says it's just not possible to improve the economies there, and the best solution may be for people to just move. But Daily Yonder editor Tim Merrima has a different opinion.
Should we stay or should we go? It's hard to tell from reading the New York Times. In a Times Magazine piece called The Problem with Eastern Kentucky, Annie Lowry says mountain residents should hit the road to find economic opportunity. She says anti-poverty programs are just hurting the economy in the long run because they don't encourage mobility. But in another Times story, this one about Detroit, Monica Davey reports that the Motor City desperately needs to hold on to residents to keep the city viable. The stories are night and day. From rural Kentucky, Lowry says remaining in a distressed area is bad for the economy and for individuals. From Detroit, there's a different story. What the city needs most is for people to stay put. So why do two stories, both covering regions in economic distress, both dealing with migration, printed within days of each other in the same publication, focus on such different solutions? Well, gee, let me think. Could it have something to do with the fact that Detroit is urban and eastern Kentucky is rural? In Detroit, people are assets, the building blocks of a new future. In rural Kentucky, they're liabilities, the remnants of a failed economic past. The frames of these two stories presuppose two very different public policy responses. If people are assets, investing in them yields dividends. If they're liabilities, well, it's money down the drain. Lowry's facts about eastern Kentucky aren't wrong. She builds her analysis off New York Times research that says 6 of the 10 toughest counties to live in the United States are in eastern Kentucky. No, the problem is her smug conclusion that rural people are, at best, pieces of a puzzle to be moved into a more efficient position, and, at worst, just a drain on the economy. Either way, rural Americans have ceased to be actors in their own affairs. They're a problem for the smart city folks to solve. I'd love a good discussion about rural and urban poverty. Let's talk about public policy and how we can move forward together as a nation. Because there's an awful lot of things that cities need from rural America. Fiber, fuel, food, and, yes, people. But remember, while we're having this discussion, rural folks are standing right here. You know we can hear you, right?
Tim Merrima is editor of the Daily Yonder, which is published by the Center for Rural Strategies in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Merrima is from eastern Kentucky and lives in Norris, Tennessee. One Appalachian town that's looking to turn itself around is Matewan, a historic mining town in Mingo County in southern West Virginia. West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis has more on the continuing effort to revitalize the area.
The small town full of history is hoping that a key to turning things around is finding a way to increase tourism in the area. Known for its connections to the Hatfield-McCoy feud, some residents think the way to change things is to provide attractions for outsiders to come in and visit the area. Among the ideas is to better capitalize on the Hatfield-McCoy Trail, used by ATV riders throughout the southern part of the state. David Hatfield is a resident of the town whose heritage runs deep.
Matewan's long overdue for this, and this town is near and dear to my heart. Sid Hatfield was my great-great-uncle. He was involved in the mine wars in the 1920s, and somehow I feel compelled and obligated to be here to try to help out.
But it's not just the use of ATVs. Hatfield and others would like to see shops and artisan centers develop in the town, along with the idea that with the creation of an amphitheater, the area could turn into a destination for West Virginia residents to come see plays. Hatfield tells a story of a visit to Pigeon Forge in Tennessee as why his small town could turn into an attractive tourism spot.
First time in 1987 or 88 when I went down there to Pigeon Forge to go out to Dollywood, it was a road similar to 119 or even 1056 over on the Kentucky side here. And it was 3 hours from downtown Pigeon Forge to Dollywood in bumper-to-bumper traffic going in and 2.5 hours to come back out. So that being said, now there's a four-lane highway being expanded to 6 lanes.
It's those ideas of similar areas that have become attractions that people like Hatfield are looking to as an example of how things could be with the right changes. According to Hatfield, the keys to turning things around are threefold: teamwork, investment, and a lot of hard work. Hatfield and the rest of the group of active Matewan citizens met last night for the first of 3 workshops to hash out and continue to develop 20 different plans to turn Matewan around. Ideas range from becoming a theatrical hub to walking and biking areas and renovations of historic sites. They'll use grants from the Benedum Foundation that could see an influx of $75,000 into the community by the end of the project. Ellen Hatfield says there is unrealized potential in the area.
Because I see this has a lot of potential, and it's got a lot of character and history behind it. And I can see it becoming into a really good tourism place.
Kelly Webb was excited about the continued progress.
Now it's time for people to take action, and they said they want to do these projects. Well, it's time to do that. As long as we can get other people involved, and hopefully everyone will group together and really break down and work the projects. That's what needs to be done if we're going to turn the town around.
David Hatfield says in the end, it's going to come down to whether people work together like they should to make this effort different than ones in the past.
I think what we've had in the past is that everybody's been trying to go their own way on projects. And without a cohesive effort and a comprehensive plan, things seem to fail on their own. And I believe if we can pull it together, we won't have that problem this time.
The next 2 workshops will be on July 16th and August 7th. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Matewan.
Coming up Inside Appalachia, an in-depth look at just what Wheeling, West Virginia's name means. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The name Wheeling is an old word. While there's some dispute, it most commonly is translated from the indigenous Delaware language as Place of the Skull. That's the name and subject of a new book recently published. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board spoke with Ohio Valley resident and author of the book, Alan Fitzpatrick, and brings us this report.
Wheeling is not an English word.
An interest in genealogy pointed Alan Fitzpatrick down a dark path of the history of the Ohio Valley. It's a history so bloody that traces of 200-year-old atrocities are still prominent today in unexpected places.
In the Delaware language, there's 2 words linked together. Wheel, lunk. Wheel, lunk. Wheeling. And lunk means place of, and wheel means head or skull.
Wheeling is nicknamed the Friendly City, but the name itself, Wheeling, actually has ominous beginnings.
What happened here? Mm-hmm. Something happened. Indians did not name places randomly for no reason.
Legend has it that Wheeling is the place where an early white settler was murdered by natives. His severed head was put on top of a pole as a warning to other settlers. But until now, no one has ever really tried to substantiate the story. Fitzpatrick first learned about the legend from Wheeling historian Margaret Brennan. He dedicated the book to her, in fact, and credits Brennan in part for inspiring him to investigate the matter. But there were a couple of other motivating factors behind him undertaking this investigation. Place of the Skull is actually the 3rd book Fitzpatrick has written about 18th century indigenous Americans. His interest was sparked in the subject when he began to look at his own family tree. He discovered one of his American ancestors fought with native tribes and the British during the Revolutionary War against other Americans. Fitzpatrick then discovered there were many who fought with the indigenous people.
The American side did not know how many white men had gone over to the Indians who were sympathetic, who could speak the language, who were with them fighting against their own people.
He discovered this overseas in England, where he found a treasure trove of historical documents meticulously taken and maintained by the British before and during the American Revolution. Some 42,000 letters and documents exist there, Fitzpatrick says, and were the basis of his first book, The Wilderness War on the Ohio. Those same documents also informed Place of the Skull.
I came across many references in letters written by these white men who were fighting with the Indians, who are writing letters to the British, who are mentioning a place called Wheeling, that the Indians are talking about Wheeling. These are Indians who have never been to Wheeling. For some reason, Wheeling holds a certain spell over them. And when you read the letters, you get the feel of it. They're always talking about Wheeling. And this is as a place, almost like a place of mind, not a exact spot.
Fitzpatrick also notes a war tactic anomaly that captured his curiosity. The last battle of the American Revolution was fought in Wheeling. Fitzpatrick explains it was peculiar because the fort in Wheeling wasn't a significant post, nor could it be taken easily. And yet, for 3 days they tried.
Why would Indians spend 3 days attacking a fort when that went against every principle of warfare that they understood and had practiced?
Fitzpatrick was intrigued. So he began a search to discover the story behind Wheeling.
I had to approach it like this was a cold case. And I'm not going to come up with a body. And I'm not going to come up with people who can testify. I've got to find some very tight circumstantial evidence. And so I started to roll the clock back.
The search led to studying 18th century indigenous customs, especially those regarding a man's skull being severed from his body and put on display atop a planted post. Not an especially easy task.
I can count on one hand the number of instances recorded from 1710 to the end of the French and Indian War when Indians severed a man's head and put it on a post. They didn't do this for recreation. It was not a random act of violence.
Fitzpatrick points out that white people had very little insight to the native mindset then, and so we naturally still have a very shallow understanding of their perspectives. But he has been able to glean some understanding by interviewing modern indigenous Americans schooled in traditional cultures.
To us today, if we see that man injure that person over there or kill that person, slay them, that man is guilty of the act, and that for whatever the motive is, and we're going to punish him. But in Indian understanding of things, 18th century, there is no difference between an evil act and an evil person and an evil place. They are one and the same. There is an evil spirit. And so the skull on the post is a warning to Indians, you see, that there's something bad has happened here to us.
So Fitzpatrick dove into research to try to piece together an event that would merit a warning that still lingers today, 200 years later.
It was probably, I'm going to say, the darkest chapter of American history that ever happened. More than the Civil War, maybe the numbers of casualties weren't as high, but it was as close to ethnic cleansing as any war has been, because these two peoples, the gulf of misunderstanding and mistrust was just so wide that they could not come together on anything.
Alan Fitzpatrick, author of several books that explore America in the 18th century, says when indigenous people severed a head from a body and displayed it, not only did it forever damn that spirit to unrest, it also marked an evil the indigenous Americans feared wanted to destroy them. And of course, in a way, they were right.
Severing the skull was a way of ultimate vengeance, and now we strike upon the heart of how Native American people viewed things at that time. Vengeance was at the top of their list. Tribal people today, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, will fight each other until no one's left, all over vengeance.
Fitzpatrick's search to discover the root of the legend of the beheaded white settler and the source of the name Wheeling took him to the mid-1700s. He spent a lot of time in the Pennsylvania archives piecing together the scene.
I know in 1749 there's no white settlers. None. Zero. That part of the legend is false. None arrive until 25 years later. The French were on an expedition. There are no Frenchmen, French settlers. There's no war. There's no white people this side of the mountains to have a war with. You see, so who is this white man? What's he doing there? What white men were here?
What is known is that a well-established east-west path used by many tribes crosses through Wheeling and, in fact, still exists today as National Road or Route 40. Fitzpatrick reports that in the 18th century, tribes and clans would come to the area to hunt, as well as trade for European goods. And as Europeans continued to land on the East Coast, Native tribes were increasingly displaced westward. Fitzpatrick says in the mid to early 1700s, white men were beginning to cross the mountains with trains of horses to trade goods with Native people who were, in turn, hungry for European goods and technologies. He says white traders, licensed by the Pennsylvania government, hired rough-and-tumble, hardy frontiersmen to help with the expeditions and the horses. And the traders often carried rum as a gift and social lubricant.
The men that they hired got the idea that now they know the trail, now they know how cheap rum is to buy. What if they bring 15 horses loaded with rum only and get there before the licensed traders do, and get the Indians drunk, and take all their furs?
In the 1730s, reports began to flood in. Whole villages would be engulfed in rum, and then would be robbed. It was lucrative, Fitzpatrick says, so rampant corruption followed.
Imagine now that there's any way to police this across the mountains. There's no way. The government can do nothing. The government says to the Indians, this is your problem.
Fitzpatrick goes on to explain that what happened next was most likely inevitable.
And there's a little note in the archives that a fellow named Hendricks was down the Ohio River during this time period, his word comes in 1744, gets to Philadelphia, that he heard guns go off and heard shrieks, unnamed place, but that the Indians were killing somebody. Mm-hmm. And therein is the most likely explanation for that somebody was caught.
Fitzpatrick says rum traders continued with their business, but it was after that point, and as settlers did move west over the next 30 years, that settlers and indigenous people began to encounter Wheelunk. To Native people, it was a place to be avoided and a source of white evil. Fitzpatrick speculates that the reason Fort Henry continued to be attacked was because some tribes were trying with abandon and in vain to fight that evil back.
Akin to the closest thing I can come up with is I've never been to Poland, but I know somewhere in Poland, in my mind, when I think of Poland, I think there's a little town somewhere called Auschwitz, and I've never seen it, But I know in my mind that it was a place of evil was done there against Jewish people. And to Native Americans, to Indians who'd never been to Wheeling, the legacy persisted. After there's war, several wars, Lord Dunmore's War, the American Revolution, the French and Indian War. Indians were quick to blame that the source was Wheeling, that it came from Wheeling, that there was an evil spirit at Wheeling, that it was a white man's evil spirit, not an Indian evil spirit, that this was a place to be avoided, that this evil spirit wanted to destroy Indians. You see, in their mind, that's how they perceived it.
Fitzpatrick says in his mind, the mystery is put to rest, and his books are his attempt to correct history and to try to put a human face on the nameless, displaced savage who lived here before the white man. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Boyd in McMeekin.
While Place of the Skull explores the dark and mysterious origins of Wheeling's name, another book by a Huntington, West Virginia native and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, Julia Keller, digs into what can be the dark side of life in a small Appalachian town. Keller recently sat down with NPR's Noah Adams to talk about her third novel about a fictitious West Virginia town and a prosecutor there who's fighting the community's drug problem.
When Julia Keller talks, you can notice a touch of West Virginia. It's her home state. Her accent may be faded some during her newspaper career in Chicago, so when she started thinking about writing crime novels, she was happy to hear the Appalachian voices coming out of memory.
I was probably the most surprised person of all when I chose to set my fiction in West Virginia. Hadn't lived here in a long time, didn't really know that it moved in my blood, if it did.
Turns out it did. And Julia Keller, the writer, learned it helps when you're imagining something awful, go where it could happen. She had a river she wanted to show me. Rivers, she says, can be mysterious, dark metaphors. One of her books is about the killing of a young girl, and Keller already knew what the riverbank crime scene might look like.
I have to thank my journalism career for that. I was, as a general assignment reporter, once called out to a story. They'd found a car in a river, shallow river, much like this. And the photographer and I went out, and we all kind of waited breathlessly as they were hoisting up the car. Looks like this great rusty behemoth. Instantly, all this red water began rushing out of it, this red substance, and we're all thinking, oh my God, it's blood. And of course, it was rust. And then they gave the all clear. There wasn't anything in it. It was just an abandoned car.
To talk with Julia Keller, we've come to a community in West Virginia that is close to where she grew up.
Sign says, welcome to historic Guyandot, established 1810. A few potholes begin to appear in the road, a few more potholes.
Let's say you want to be a crime fiction writer. You start with a main character. Julia Keller invented Belle Elkins. She's a lawyer and absolutely idealistic. And then you need a location. Keller decided to create a fictional town. Guyandot, where we are on this day, was often an inspiration, but the small town called Acker's Gap in the novels really came to life just in her mind.
I don't have to make up anymore what's there. I know what's there. I know what the streets look like. I know what the people look like. I know what the courthouse looks like. It is, in some ways, more real than the world that I see. Acker's Gap was a shabby afterthought of a town, tucked in the notch between two peaks of the Appalachian Mountains, like the last letter stuck in a mail slot after the post office has closed down for keeps.
That's how she described it in her first book, a disintegrating town, a polluted river, coal mines abandoned. Keller wanted to focus on drug issues in a place with no escape. In her very first scene that she wrote, three old men are in a cafe drinking coffee on a Saturday morning laughing, and someone walks in and kills them. As Keller puts it, pock, 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 one shot per head. Belle Elkins is the prosecuting attorney who will go after the killer. Elkins was born in this town. She'd moved back with her daughter. She could have stayed in a big money career in Washington, D.C.
She could have. She has a law degree from a top flight university, Georgetown. I mean, her marriage is over, but she certainly had a social life there, a support network, professional and personal. So why does she do this thing?
Elkins returned to West Virginia determined and fierce. Makes mistakes but solves cases. Keeps a 12-gauge shotgun underneath her bed.
And I love that about her. One of the things I wanted to do with having a female protagonist is to allow her to have her anger. If we let women have a little more of their anger and to speak their minds, we'd have a very different kind of world.
Tell me about this cemetery.
This is Ridgelawn Cemetery, and it's where everybody I'm related to, who's not here anymore, is buried. This is my father's grave here. He died quite young. He was 52.
James Keller had been a math professor. His father worked in a factory, and the Keller men before that were coal miners. So Julie takes special notice of that life. Back when she was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, they sent her deep into West Virginia.
And I had long conversations with the wife of a coal miner there. And she had created a whole section under the kitchen table for her husband with pillows and blankets and reading matter and everything he needed to live because he was only comfortable crouching over.
What Julia Keller heard that day years ago about what could happen to a man who worked bent over underground became one of her plot lines. A retired miner who can't straighten up and has dementia, lives with his young daughter, needs to live in the dark basement. She's put rocks down there and piles of dirt. As the book continues, he is suspected of attacking people in the woods.
Coming up immediately on our right is a gas station that I always think of. In fact, I put in book three, Summer of the Dead.
She's been intrigued by the convenience store gas stations in the West Virginia small towns. Open late, young people on staff. For a crime fiction writer, a place like that is where the stories are just waiting. All right. We stop at the Guyandotte station and meet Michelle Day.
What kind of shift do you work?
I work the evening shift, 3 to 11, 2 to 10.
Yeah.
I love working here at this station. I get to meet, you know, I see the same people every day. It's nice.
And Lynn Daniels is the store manager. He says the front door has an electronic lock. The switch is behind the counter.
And that's usually what we do in the evenings. We keep the door locked until we see somebody coming up to the door and, you know, we recognize them or, you know, can tell that they don't have a mask on or anything like that or a gun in their hand, you know. So then we open the door for them.
Julia Keller won a Pulitzer Prize for a newspaper series. She has a PhD in English literature, teaches at Ohio University. And she does love writing about murders, drugs, and kidnapping. Sometimes, she says, people have the idea that crime fiction is a lesser genre.
I cannot tell you how deeply I reject that. Every piece of literary fiction I read these days, I think of as crime fiction, because it is. Hamlet is crime fiction. To Kill a Mockingbird is crime fiction. Heaven knows, Oedipus is crime fiction.
The next book in Julia Keller's series about the prosecuting attorney Belle Elkins is Summer of the Dead. It comes out in late August. Noah Adams, NPR News.
Up next, we catch up with photographer Roger May to see how his Looking at Appalachia project is coming along. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Just like Shane Simmons and Jason Barton in our first segment, Roger May documents life in Appalachia. Instead of video, May uses still photography. This year, May is hoping to update the portrait of Appalachia by replacing those old black-and-white photographs from the War on Poverty that still stand today as representative of the region with new, modern, and more colorful images. I recently caught up with May to see how the project Looking at Appalachia is going.
Yeah, so we've gotten some pretty good feedback so far. I think, you know, anytime you crowdsource something, just the nature of crowdsourcing anything takes some time for the word to get disseminated. And I think that's very much been the case with this project. But it has made a few rounds, and we're starting to gain some interest and some more submissions. I've been kind of reaching out to folks and kind of gently nudging them and giving them a reminder that, you know, hey, this project is going on, and we're you know, coming up on the halfway point, or we're at the halfway point. My hope is that the summer months and early fall months, especially, we'll start to see quite a few photos coming in.
Now, following you on Twitter and checking out the website every once in a while, I noticed you weren't getting photos and submissions from all the Appalachian states. How's that going as far as getting some of the ones that aren't participating involved?
It's a little tricky. I think, again, trying to convince people that Appalachia is expanded far beyond our general understanding of what the region is a bit of a challenge. And I can only imagine other organizations, much larger organizations and groups that do work that target Appalachia, what they go through when they're trying to work with communities within the region. And folks still have this very sort of cemented view of where Appalachia is or what Appalachia is. So, we did get our first submissions in from New York, which I thought was pretty exciting. Continuing to get the word out there and asking photographers and writers and folks on Facebook and other social media platforms to help spread the word. It's been really, really amazing to watch it take off.
How many places are you missing so far at this point?
We're missing South Carolina, Mississippi, New York, and Alabama. So nine of the 13 states, we have at least one image from those regions. So I'm really hoping, ideally I'd love to see 100 to 150 really well curated images per state by the end of this thing. And that may be overly ambitious, but we'll see.
What kind of a picture do you see being painted of the region so far? From the perspective of the content, what's it telling you about the region?
It's just showing me America. I mean, I think it's showing me a more of a microscopic view of America, of what I see as sort of anywhere USA. It's showing me families fishing. It's showing me landscapes, rolling hills and trees. It's showing me roller derby, slices of daily life that I would expect to find anywhere in America, which, I hope communicates to folks that, Appalachia is in fact, very much like America.
How does that contrast to the 1960s War on Poverty photographs that you've seen of Appalachia?
The context that those pictures were made in, was very, very, the very dire circumstances. And I understand at the time that they were intended to portray just how dire the poverty was in certain regions of the country. But what I feel came out of those pictures was that, this is how the entire region is. And therefore, we've got to do something about this entire region.
What do you hope this project does as far as changing that?
Well, I'm really excited about the educational component of this, the opportunity for youth to get involved with this and for youth to be sort of impacted by and even guided by this project or these photographs, as opposed to seeing, dirty, emaciated children from the 1960s and those photographs, to seeing, kids in these photographs and families and communities in these photographs throughout this project show much more of a sort of an everyday America.
I guess it's hard. People don't realize what Appalachia entails, do they?
No, I think their way of thinking, much like mine was for a number of years, is very limited to thinking that Appalachia is very much just centrally located in West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, East Tennessee, Western North Carolina, Southwest Virginia, kind of the small cluster of states and areas there. But when you're talking to someone from Southern New York State, they know that the Appalachian Trail goes through New York, but they don't really think of that part of New York as being a part of Appalachia as a whole.
You've also been allowing some photographers to curate, I think, the Instagram page. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So one of the ways that I thought would be really fun to reach a different audience was to use a different platform for this project and to use the Instagram feed for to promote the project and to have a little more candid and less defined a collection of pictures. So I've reached out to some photographers and I had a few reach out to me to inquire about taking over the Instagram feed for a few days. And that's just been hugely popular. We've had a lot of success with that. And I think we've had maybe five or six guest Instagrammers to this at this point, including myself. And so if anyone is interested in doing that, if they'll get in touch with me and include their a link to their Instagram feed, I'd like to look at some of their work and make sure that they're a good fit for the project. But you know, we also want to make sure that folks in Mississippi and Alabama, as well as all the way up in New York, have an opportunity to manage the Instagram feed as well, to have their respective parts of the project represented through the Instagram.
Are you having fun with this?
It's a blast. I'm really having a blast. I mean, it is a lot of work. I have a full-time job and then in addition to doing my own photographic work, but that's one of the things that I enjoy the most about it is that, you know, it is my project, but it's so much bigger than me and it's so much more fun knowing that so many other people are getting something out of it. It's so much bigger than it, really any of us. And my hope is that at the end of the project, we're all able to sort of look back and really be proud of what, you know, maybe we've never even met some of these folks that we've worked with, but we can collectively be proud of what we've accomplished.
Well, Roger May, thanks for talking with us about your project.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you so much.
In our final segment, we'll meet a West Virginia soldier who serves in a very special Army unit. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. This 4th of July marks the 239th anniversary of the United States of America. A few years after the Continental Congress signed the Declaration of Independence, back in 1784, Congress created the oldest active-duty infantry unit in the Army, which is known as the Old Guard. West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly tells us about a soldier from Princeton who was recently chosen to help carry on the traditions of this historic unit.
The Infantryman's Creed. I am the infantry. I am my country's strength at war, her to turn in peace. I am the heart of the fight, wherever, whenever. I carry America's faith and honor against her enemies. I am the queen of battle. I am what my country expects me to be, the best trained soldier in the world. In the race for victory, I am swift, determined, and courageous, armed with a fierce will to win. Never will I fail my country's trust.
When 19-year-old Nathan Thomas Cooper, who usually goes by Thomas, first took the Infantryman's Creed, it wasn't clear where the United States Army would take him.
To hunger, to cowardice, to fatigue, to superior odds, for I am mentally tough, physically strong, and morally straight. I forsake not my country, my mission, my comrades, my sacred duty. I am relentless. I am always there, now and forever. I am the infantry.
Kansas,
follow me.
The Sunflower State. West Virginia, the Mountain State. Nevada.
Last July 4th, the Presidential Salute Battery of the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, also known as the Old Guard, fired a traditional 50-gun salute at Whipple Field in Virginia to salute each of the 50 states. Taps. A standard part of U.S. military funerals since 1891 plays in Arlington on a regular basis. And again, it's soldiers of the Old Guard who are responsible for carrying out these traditions at Fort Myer and around the Washington, D.C. area.
Don't just take anybody.
Private Thomas Cooper of Princeton in Mercer County was honored when he was selected to serve in the Old Guard straight out of basic training, which he explains doesn't happen often.
Looking at some of my other fellow soldiers that I went through basic with, a lot of them are a lot bigger than me, a lot more weight. If you're too muscular, it's you're just too big. You know, you don't fit in the uniform right. That's another thing they look at. If you don't fit in the uniform right, you can't do it. I mean, you can't be bulging out of your uniform because your chest is too big.
To be a member of the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, the soldier must stand at least 6 feet tall, weigh between 150 and 180 pounds, and have a specific bone structure. Besides the physical characteristics, Thomas's mother, Nicole Ellis, suspects that his attitude was also important.
He has strong morals, and when he sets his mind to something, that's what he's going to do, and he doesn't let anything or anyone stop him. He's always been very headstrong. That one right there was, he's my fire. He's just so full of life and was always so full of life. He was never afraid of anything. And his many scars and broken bones show all of that. He always took everything head on.
Cooper was originally assigned to go to Fort Carson, Colorado, on a striker unit and expected to be deployed to Iraq within months.
If my orders would have stayed the same at Fort Carson, Colorado, I would have been deployed to Iraq. Who knows how long I would have been there. It's just war. That's all it is over there. It's just war. Nobody cares. It's different. I know that. My drill sergeants, they've explained it to us the best of their ability, and war is not something that you want to go through. It takes a mental toll, like on your brain. At least three would be dead. At least three. I could have been one of those three.
The more I read about the Old Guard and the more I talked to people that knew what the Old Guard was, I just couldn't believe that, you know.
Thomas's mother, Nicole Ellis.
He's everything to me and his family. But to the rest of the world, you know, he's a nobody from just a nowhere little town. And they picked him. He was chosen. The pride that I feel, knowing how far he's come, seeing the determination and the change in him. He was a good kid. And in 4 short months, he walked out of there an amazing man.
While Ellis is relieved to have her son much closer to home, she says, for a mother, the worry doesn't stop.
When he first told me about the whole military thing, I couldn't help but feel a sense of pride. But there was also instant fear, you know, and it scared me. But I knew, if that's what he wanted to do, that's what he was going to do. And the only thing that I knew to do as his mom was to support him and love him.
But she says the pride doesn't stop either.
You know, he's a part of something that's so much bigger than anybody can imagine. He's made me very proud.
Other responsibilities of the Old Guard include guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, an honor that Cooper hopes to earn, but he says won't happen anytime soon. In the meantime, he's currently in the firing party, a group that participates in the 21-gun salute for honored military veterans. Cooper will be trying out for the caisson platoon, which includes the soldiers that ride on horses that escort the fallen soldiers to the final resting place at Arlington National Cemetery.
I said before I didn't want to go to war, but, you know, if necessary, I will fight to my death. You know, I am always there now and forever. I am the infantry. Follow me. We'll lead the way.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Princeton.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.